This is Gino the announcer, and you are listening to the Barbell Program Podcast with Peter and Alex. The bar is loaded.
Okay, now everything should work.
Okay. First of all, Tom, we really appreciate that you take your time and doing a podcast with us in these times when everybody is at home and there's a lot of new things going on and nobody knows how the next day will be. And thank you very much for taking your time for that.
Well, it's my pleasure to be here.
Perhaps you can introduce yourself a little bit to the audience.
Yeah, my name is Tom Barry, and I work at Westside Barbell. I've been here for 9 going on 10 years. I've been a strength coach, for say about 15 years. And my main demographic, I work with pro MMA, football players, golf athletes, mostly all the athletes that Louis doesn't work with. That's where I fall into. And yeah, so then met you guys, what was it, nearly a year ago?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we were introduced to Kevin Costner over at Slater's Hardware.
We have to tell the story, I think.
Yes.
Tom was, you know, it was one of the best things at the whole on the whole trip through the U.S. because Tom was driving us around. All around Columbus and Ohio and Lancaster and everywhere, he just took us with him, and we were talking in the car and sharing experiences and sharing training programs. And we also met a couple of super cool people like Slater. Steve Slater, and this is the guy who is producing the Slater logs for the Arnold Classics and the Slater Stones. And he has a hardware store in Lancaster, I think is the name.
Yep.
Lancaster, Ohio. And I first saw this guy, and he looked like, or he looks like Kevin Costner. and I told Tom, and we were loving it. And from then on, we only see Kevin Costner showing us some big locks, introducing us to his family. And this was a nice trip. It was back in August.
Yeah,
19. This was super cool.
So it's a very cool shop with all that little strongman corner. There's a lot of history in that one little hardware store.
I really can tell everybody who is close, he should drive by and walk in. Yeah. Because there is the, I think the Hammer Tire deadlift is there.
Yeah, yeah.
Original Hammer Tire deadlift. Nice. Yeah, and the Slater logs, and you know, in the basement they are building the Slater Stones. That's super cool. We also ordered from Slater,
mm-hmm.
but he needs a little bit more time. So I think he's finished in a couple of months. Hopefully now, you know, things are changing. But we really can't wait to get, you know, the logs, the stones. So that's super cool.
That's badass.
Yeah. Okay. But you told us that you are primarily working with MMA athletes and MMA fighters or football football players. And what? We were talking in the car, but perhaps you can tell us about your strength and conditioning approach with those athletes. So, what's your approach to strength and conditioning in general?
So, been under Louis for so long, you kind of get skewed, and it's skewed in the good direction. Is that we try to keep everything super simple, and I think too many people complicate strength training. So we try to remove all the complications and be more, again, structured and structured from the inside out. And what that means is that when we get an athlete, the most important part is the assessment. If you don't assess an athlete right, then how can you train him right? Basically, you're going to ask all the wrong questions and then answer them correctly, but they're never going to get as good as they could be. So the system, I take everything I learned from Louis, and then of course you're going to add in your own experiences through it from trial and error. And then we start with the joints, and then from the joints we work outwards. And if at the start of working with an athlete, if you go on the premise by making them a better human, so if they can function betterly as a person, well then they're going to function better as an athlete, and then you can refine your training. to where you work in energy systems, regardless of the sport, in regards to the sport. But super simple, work from the joint outwards to make sure you have full joint capacity. Because if you don't have joint capacity, what you're going to do is build up compensations. And then if you build up compensations, then you're going to get randomly injured. And you're like, I didn't see it coming. And then you get, you're like, oh, what happened? And it's because your joints lost capacity. And then you just, the body adapts around them. So it's very important for us to see where all the joints are at and make sure we have full capacity and full range of motion that you should have within the joints. Then once that's addressed, then we go into the fun stuff, which is like lifting heavy weights. To me, in nearly every demographic I've worked with, being stronger in a maximal sense has had huge carryover, especially if you take jiu-jitsu. We have guys that are skillful, but they're not the most skilled yet. And brute strength has helped them overcome some situations where skill would have been a huge factor. But yeah, so I try to keep things as simple as possible. If you look at it from a systems perspective, no successful complex system ever starts out complex. It starts out really simple. So if you start out simple, then you can make it more complex and more specific to that given athlete, rather than trying to make this big complex program and try to like fool people by intensity and like, oh my God, that was such a hard workout. Well, was it really hard, or was it just hard because you picked hard exercises? And it's to read the biggest issue I had when I was first here was that I was making powerlifters, and I'm like, oh, okay, I'm not training powerlifters, I'm training to say MMA athletes. I had forgotten some of the other aspects. So you take the fundamental principles of what Louis teaches at Westside, and then you take the principles of the sport and you mix them together. And then that was a huge turning point for our athletes training. Well, for my athletes training from the experiences here.
May I ask you, how many sessions per week do you get with your athletes? Like, for example, you get an MMA fighter?
MMA is hard because they have so many other disciplines to train for. But usually, a minimum, they're in the gym with me 3 times a week. And then they'll have 3 of their own sessions outside of here. And those 3 days is we do 1 max effort for upper, 1 max effort for lower. And then we got 1 dynamic effort for both upper and lower. Mm-hmm. And then we choose accessories based on their strengths, weaknesses. And then we put in conditioning with that too.
For example, if one athlete has kind of an injury and his range of motion is impaired, let's put it like that, so he cannot go down full range of motion, for example, in the squat. How do you train with those athletes? Do you skip the heavy stuff, or do you still pushing it?
So what we do is we define whatever the safety range is. Mm-hmm. So just if you take a squat, it's a good example. And we know that you can squat to maybe half your range of motion safely. Then what we'll do is, firstly, we've addressed the issue. We send this. So I work hand in hand with John Quint, who's a functional therapist here, and he's a huge part of our training. So his job, he works specifically in increasing capacity in the joints. So John has done the assessment, say, hey, this athlete is safe to train within half the given range of motion for a squat. So my job is to build up that as strong as possible as he's working on the joint aspect. Mm. Then we'll keep assessing. And then if John goes, hey, we now have 3/4 range of motion, so you have to start building up that capacity. So then I work within the 3/4 range of motion. And until we get back to where you should be, we never stop training. Because if you stop training, the central nervous system gets no stimulus. And if it gets no stimulus, all it can do is go backwards and get lazy, and then that's why athletes can spend such a long time coming back from injury.
You know, I was talking to you in the car, and you told me about this concept a little bit about, you know, just hammering the range of motion that's safe and working on the joint capacity in the accessory work, for example, or in special, you know, routines beside your training. And I was pretty screwed for 2 years because of some kind of big injuries in my back and the hip and the knee and so on. And I started to, you know, implement this kind of approach a little bit. And, you know, I don't know if this was the only reason why it's better now, but I'm, you know, I'm painless, you know, completely. So it's completely away. You know, I don't mess around with deep squats now, but they are getting pretty deep again, you know.
Yeah.
But I don't care about them. And I also told Peter, and he said, okay, yeah, that's kind of cool stuff. Just don't go deep. And it worked. It really worked, and it helped me mentally too, because I could push it again, you know. I just can add some weight on the bar, and that is what strength training is about. And if you take this away from me, you know, I'm I get mentally ill.
Yeah, well, and again, it's your mind is a huge asset, or can be a huge enemy to you, especially when you're an athlete, and all you love to do is train. And most of the athletes I work with, I have to pull them back more so than, like, I have to push them, because they all want to go 100% all the time. But it's huge. I remember Dr. Eric Spina, or Andre Spina, sorry, said force is the universal language of cells. And that's so true. So if you eliminate all force into your body, well, then it can't adapt to anything. And if it can't adapt to anything, it's going to maladapt. And anything that maladapts goes backwards. And then this is why this injury cycle can become so vicious. Mm-hmm. So it all goes back to the assessments. So once you have your initial assessment, then every 8 weeks here, we have reassessments just to see where everyone's going. So we always have data. And the big thing that we do is never subjective. Everything is always objective. Mm-hmm. That way we can present the athlete or the coach, here's objective data to make your subjective judgment on. If you have subjective data and they look at it through their own subjective eyes,
it's double subjective.
Exactly. And then that's chaos ensues. Yeah. And that's where bad decisions happen. And then that's where these random injuries occur. The biggest issue we see by far is the hip joint's been stuck in place. And that's where all these lower back injuries come from, psoas issues, and MCL, PCL tears, all because you have a hip that's not rotating in the joint correctly. Mm-hmm. And the way the mechanoreceptors work in the joints, it's all automated. So just say that's 360, or roughly whatever your version of full capacity. And then injury occurs, or over time you lose capacity, then it goes to something like this. Well, the body still thinks you have this. What's happening is the whole body is compensating around that joint. Mm. It starts torquing on the back. The back's built to flex, not to torque. So then that's where this lower back pain comes, but no one ever treats the cause. They go straight for the symptom. Yeah. So if you've got a screwed up lower back, let's fix that lower back, not thinking that it could be stemming from the hip. And I would really say that 95% of all issues we get is from poor or lack of capacity in the hip joints.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty much what happened to you, Alex.
This was like you were describing my injury.
Yeah.
Right now.
And it comes out of nowhere. And that's the big shock with it, because you can be healthy and happy and doing whatever, and then over a period of 2 weeks, you're like, what the hell just happened to me?
Absolutely. And everything went south, you know, from 1 second to the other.
Yeah. And that's why it's so important to where you have systems in place to where if something happens, and that's what, not just in strength and conditioning, but being here with Louis, you end up reading books way outside the curve. So I started reading books on manufacturing and lean manufacturing systems. And they have a thing called root cause analysis, RCAs. So if you implement that into strength training, it means as soon as something out of the normal happens, you identify it and you assess. So just say in the assessment, if we noticed that some of your hip joint capacity was lost, well, we already have an assessment in place to ensure feedback. And if we notice that it's down by 5 or 10 degrees, well, then we have a plan in place to increase that capacity. It's the checks and balances approach, which I think too many people get into a routine of, they assess at the start of the year, they go through their whole season, and then they might reassess again the end of the year, or maybe do it twice a year. The great thing with the Westside system or the Westside conjugate approach is that every week we got feedback coming, how strong you are, how fast you are your weaknesses building up, how to build them up. And then with working with John, then we have weekly assessments on your hips and joints. So basically our athletes, we have all this objective data that's easily digestible to where we can make the best decisions possible. And to me, a dynamic approach is way better than a fixed or a linear approach.
Mm-hmm. You know, Peter, yesterday we were talking about a little bit about Bondarchuk's methods. I sent you a video. Mm. And we were talking to Mike Toshira 4 days ago. And people think that these are two different kinds of a spectrum. You know, on one side there is there's Mike, and on the other side there is, for example, West Side methods. But it all comes together. All the really good systems are just trying to be as less complicated as possible and trying to assess as many things as possible and finding out what really works and what doesn't. It's close.
Yeah, and I mean, look, I understand there's a business side to this, and everyone has their systems and their methods, but Louis said there's two ways to train. There's training correctly and there's training incorrectly. We all might have different approaches to our way of training correctly, but the foundational aspects, they're all very, very similar. And then you got to think personality has an effect on how you train people. But at the core values, you're 100% correct that there's more similarities than there is not.
Yeah, otherwise you won't survive, you know. Yeah.
Can we just short come back when it comes back to training NFL players? Do you get them just in the off season, or do you train them also during the season?
So the vast majority of training is done in the off season with me. Again, when they get into in season, they have their own strength conditioning coaches where they do their own stuff. But I do some maintenance with some in the off season or in season, but primarily my work is in the off season. And these guys like get pretty banged up in the in season a lot more than people think. So really the biggest change we can work on is maximal strength, because depending on the person, I may have 6 to 8 weeks. Some I may have 4, then others I may have 12. But max strength is something we can affect really quickly. Joint capacity, huge to the training, is to make sure all their joints are healthy and building that range of motion. Because once they leave here, the amount of running and sport-specific training they do is outrageous. So we got to make sure that they're leaving here with the best possible chance to perform on the worst possible day. So the constraints, it really goes on a person-by-person basis, but it's usually rebuilding them after a season and then putting them back out healthy again.
Mm-hmm. You said that you came to Westside 9 years ago.
Okay, yes.
Perhaps you can tell us, because you, hopefully it's not a secret, but you were an Irish guy, right?
Yeah.
I was, how does it come that an Irish guy is working as, let's say, Louis' right hand at Westside?
I kind of ask myself that every day. Well, I was fortunate that I was in a position back home that I was lecturing night classes in exercise and health, and I was working with athletes, and then I wanted to get more experience, so I said I'd reach, because I had no real ties there. I wasn't married, didn't have kids, so I said I'd go work with rugby. I wanted to go to New Zealand and intern with the All Blacks for a while and go around, because rugby is huge back in Europe, especially Ireland. And I remember in college, we were taught about Westside Barbell. And if you ever want to know about strength training, that Louis Simmons was I think there's an article called The Mad Monk of Powerlifting.
It was on T-Nation.
Yeah. And this is insane. I was intimidated and I was like, oh my God, look how strong the chicks would kick your ass. So I just sent an email just out of the blue, didn't expect anything of it. And I was all set. I got my visa, everything for New Zealand to go over there. And 2 days before I was supposed to go, I got an email from Louis's wife, because she used to do all the emails, because Louis handwrites everything. So Lou is sent off an email. Lou will handwrite the response and someone types it back up. And I got this email 2 days before I go, and I'm like, crap, like I have to, it's worth my bar, but I have to go. This is not I want to, like, this is a very unique opportunity. So I said I'd come here for 2 weeks. And I remember I got here, and I've never walked into a place to where I was like, oh man, I do not fit in, because everyone was just like, I walked in, and then I saw a few of the female athletes working out, and I'm like, geez, they're pretty strong. But I thought, like, this is Westside. I'm like, where are the big dudes? And then there's two sides of the gym. I walked around the corner, and there is it was AJ Roberts, it was Jake Anderson, Tony Balagoni, Brandon Lilly was back there then, Rich Douglas. I was like, holy shit. And then Lou made me jump in. I'll never forget it. He's like, okay, because I used to fight. I used to do kickbox and Muay Thai at the time. He's like, you're going to do 5 minutes every 30 seconds, 5 reps deadlifts. And he put 225 in the bar, but double over mini bands. And I've never deadlifted against mini bands. And I got about two sets in, and then I start, like, I couldn't get the weight past my knees. And Lou's like, well, you're not as strong as you look. You better go to the other side of the room. I was like, oh, all right. And that was it. Those 2 weeks, I learned a lot from Lou. And then he's like, hey, if you want to stay for another few weeks, you can. And I stayed for another month. And the two of us got in real well, because he's unbelievable fight analyst. He loves boxing, MMA. So we used to watch the fights together. And then I helped him with his education. And then 1 month turned into 2 months, 2 months into six months into 9 years. So the access to athletes and coaches and the education I got here was like nothing I've ever experienced. Like, I went through college, everything, but my first 3 months here, I really thought I knew the system. I thought I knew it inside out, and I thought I could coach anybody. And then month four, life hit me, and I was like, I don't know a thing. I know the theory behind training, but when it comes to working with top athletes, it's a whole different ballgame. And then I've been fortunate ever since. Like, Louis has got more knowledge in that brain of his than any of us can even think of getting. And he teaches you more on the fly than he does in a structured environment. He just drops these knowledge bombs that are like profound to, like, just say me, but to him it's just another day in the office. He thinks everyone is at a PhD level when it comes to strength conditioning. So you're just there trying to transcribe notes, and he talks so fast, you're like, what did he just say? And then you're making notes from there. But yeah, I wasn't supposed to be here this long, but thankfully after time grew, I ended up running the company for Lou. So that's my main occupation here. And then I work with the fighters and the football players, and that, like, Louis is powerlifting, track and field, and it's pretty amazing to see what, like, I've never seen that man stumped when it came to any sports. We had a pro BMX rider come in, mm-hmm. and I was like, this is just so unusual. And then Lou, without skipping a beat, was able to go, well, yeah, you should be doing this, 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 and this. And I think the guy went from never placing to finishing the top three. So it's very unique, and I think Lou is probably one of the most misunderstood coaches there is, because he can go on his rants and raves, and he meanders back here and tries to come back into the question been asked. But if you're around him long enough, you really see how smart the guy is. And sometimes you want to not believe. You're like, Lou, it's not this simple. And then he brings it back. It's pretty, like, keeping it simple is very fundamental.
So when it comes to exercise selection for different sports, like for example, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu fighter or stuff like that, do you keep your exercises pretty simple, or do you adapt to the sport?
I adapt mostly to the athlete and their competency level. There's some people who really enjoy the challenge of a complex exercise, and let's face it, like, there's no real exercise that's hugely complex, but the one thing that I like to do is that I don't seek out the exercise. I'm like, what is the lagging muscle group? Okay, that's the function. Which exercise gives the most stimulus to that particular muscle group or whatever the purpose is? I think a lot of people get bogged down in, hey, have you tried this exercise? Have you tried that exercise? There's thousands of exercises to choose from. It's very easy to lose the structure and get caught up in trying to do the next and greatest thing. But I try to keep it as simple as necessary. And it varies by case to case. But really, when it comes to the exercise selection, it's based on the athlete, and then it's based on the maximum amount of stimulus we can get from an exercise to target the muscle group. So I hope that makes sense. But yeah. I think a lot of people get bogged down in, hey, I'm going to do this exercise, that exercise. It's not the exercise. The exercise is just a tool. It's like, are you addressing the issue you need to fix? So you can beat a nail in with the back of a spanner if you want, but it's not as good as using the hammer. So it's kind of like just trying to find that really good exercise that suits what you're trying to do.
Yeah, that's what I'm always wondering about, because if you have a limited amount of time with an athlete, because that was my question before, if you have 3 sessions per week, that's for my experience, that's pretty good to work with an athlete. Mm-hmm. But if you just get one, sometimes you have just 1 or 2 sessions with them for a week. I think keeping it simple, like doing a squat, probably an overhead press or a deadlift, would pretty much do all the benefits, and you don't have to complicate it like that.
Correct. There's a coach called Dan DePasqua. He's the head strength coach of the Melbourne Storm. I've learned a lot from him, and he said. And Bill Gillespie, another strength coach here, said very similar things. It's all dependent on, just say if we get an athlete and we have them twice a week, well, now our selection of exercises is greatly reduced. So now we have to choose the exercise of the greater good. So rather than doing more isolation, we have to do more compound. So as you said, like squats, overhead presses, more barbell movements, because that's just that's the card you're dealt. And I think if we wasted that time to do individual work here, well, then they wouldn't get anything out of it. So you're correct in that it's all based on what time limits and constraints you have. So you have a sliding scale. If you got 4 days a week, well, then it's easy. We can like really pinpoint and get down to fine science of the accessories, isolate the joint, isolate the muscle. But if we got 2 days, well, now we've just reduced what we can choose from by half. So then that's where compound comes in. And sometimes we get an athlete, we only have them 1 day a week. And then we have to do a full body workout, as much as I hate to do them. We've got no choice. So it's kind of creating that hierarchy of what is the most essential and all the way down. But it always comes back to the assessment. That assessment should tell you everything you need to know, how many days a week they're going to be in training. Then what is the biggest issue we have to address, and that's where the trying to analyze, never criticize, but trying to analyze the athlete. Okay, this is really what we're focusing on.
It's great. It's just I was just thinking about what I was reading lately, and what the topics I was talking to, you know, with Peter and so on, and how can I say that? It's coming down to a really, really simple way of seeing training, but that makes training so much big, because it's coming down to a really simple way, but it's this simple way need you to focus on every aspect of the training. Mm-hmm. I cannot put it in other words, but it's this. Uncomplexity makes it complex on the other side, you know?
Yeah.
It makes it very individual. It makes it very, very sports focused. It you need to know much more to make it uncomplex than you need to know to make it complex, you know?
And, yeah, I agree.
You know, I'm in the business. I started training back in 1998, and studying sports science in 2002, and since then I'm just into it. And I really think that what I just learned in the last year outweighs the 20 years I learned before, which doesn't mean that this was wrong what I learned. It was very important, because you only can appreciate the things you learn when you learn something different or kind of wrong, you know. But what the last half a year or the last year from me, everything changed, you know.
I have the exact same. It's like in jiu-jitsu they say once you get your black belt, now you become a student.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's the same process. You learn, and like when you're a coach, you have a thirst for knowledge, and you read and you practice and you read and you practice, and then every year you think, I got this down, and then you realize you don't, and you keep changing. But it gives you that big base, just like a big training base does to an athlete. A big knowledge base helps us refine that pyramid to where eventually we get to that peak.
It's a kind of GMP, so general mental preparedness. You know, that's important to get some special preparedness, you know.
Crazy thing, I'm not sure if you guys have experienced this, is that the more refined and simpler it becomes, the more people don't believe it's that simple.
Yeah.
It blows my mind to where you can make things so complicated and complex, or like, this must be good because I got no idea what this means. And then you break it down, like, it's not that simple. And it's even as a coach, like, for a good while, like, you grapple with it as a coach. You're like, is it really that simple? And then, like, no, it can't be. And then you're like, yeah, it's not as complicated as some of us would make out. But again, it's all based on the experience. It's like you've spent enough time in it, just everything just falls into place. Mm. So it's crazy.
But that's why I like the jiu-jitsu approach you mentioned before, because the best submissions are those that work. And there are some fighters, they are specialized in one or two submissions, and they always do that, but they're so good at it, it just works.
It's the truth.
And it's just... to be honest, I train 95% just powerlifters, and I have the luxury that I have at least 4 sessions per week that I can try stuff with them. But it's super interesting when you work with athletes like you do that come from a different sport. You have a limited amount of time, and that's a completely new. There are completely new questions that you have to answer.
That's the truth. And out of all the sports that I've worked with, the one that I got completely fascinated with was, believe it or not, was golf. Mm-hmm. I could not believe, one, how much snake oil salesman there is in strength and conditioning in PGA golf. It's crazy. But I'm not sure if any of you guys play golf. I can't play it. I tried because I need to understand the sport. But the amount of variables you have to train for is absolutely crazy. It's one of the most interesting things for me as a strength coach in trying to organize training, because so many competitions and stuff. But just kind of to tie on from your point, is that it's having that variation as a coach is nearly as important as the athletes' exercise variation. Because to me, it keeps you fresh to where once you go, regardless, just say if your main athletes are powerlifters, it'll do you the world of good as a coach to look at all these other athletes and to have, we have these things called one-pagers. So we write as much data as we can per sport we work with. And then we'll try address like new sports and how would you train this athlete and create a fictitious environment, and just to kind of refine your skills as a coach. I think it keeps things interesting.
Mm-hmm. How do you work with those golfers, for example? I mean, how often do they? I mean, is strength training a really big part in golf for you?
Oh yeah, I like that.
It's hugely important. The biggest thing, obviously, with golf is the wear and tear it has in your joints.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a big issue to be addressed. And then increasing their maximal strength, getting them strong, had a huge carryover. However, it's very similar to working with a sprinter in that when they have more power, it affects their swing because they're able to generate more force. So something's going to be a trade-off until they get the skill up to the level of the strength. So they might lose a little bit of accuracy, but they might gain further yardage. And it's dialing that in. Like with a sprinter, you can get them, you increase their strength so much that it screws up their start because they got more power off the blocks. It's the same with the swing. And then when you increase the power, you have to make sure you got the endurance for all holes, because they'll walk on average about 10 to 11 miles a day, which is pretty crazy. Like you just see them walking around, like that's an accumulation of volume. And it's like there's just so many variables. And then tapering for competition, it's very important you get it right, because the CNS is taxed. It affects hand-eye coordination. And there's a really, really, really good book that explains this in more of a football sense. It's called The Game Changer by a man called Fergus Connolly. Very, very smart guy. But he uses analogy with Tom Brady that if you get the training right, things like just basic menial tasks, being able to get out, run the huddle, run the line, know your routes, etc., not being out of shape, allows you to make more complex tasks or complex decisions really quickly and efficiently. But if you're worried about being out of shape, then when it comes to crunch time, you've wasted all your mental reserve. So if you've got these guys walking on a golf field and just say they're about 5 miles in, walking around, they're starting to breathe heavy, well, then that's going to take away from their hand-eye coordination and mental capacity, which I found like riveting. I thought this was so interesting, to where just by increasing their GPP base had a huge effect on their hand-eye coordination. Just that one thing. Then increasing their joints and their GPP, boom, another game changer. Then you throw in max strength while they're doing all their SPP work themselves. It was really cool to see all the different areas, because you can get pretty instantaneous feedback, because every week they're on the golf course and then they're in the gym. So every week from the coaches, we're getting feedback. So very, very, very interesting.
What I want to add is that this GPP stuff, I think this was a big game changer in my training. You know, it's just 4 times a week for kind of, let's say, 20 minutes. Doing different stuff I didn't do for years, you know, which doesn't really has something to do with strength training. But suddenly I could feel that from week to week, everything got better.
And to be honest, you were really out of shape, because I'm already out of shape. And we once did the crawler together.
Yeah,
just a few weeks ago. And man, he was breathing heavy.
Yeah, but not, you know, now I'm in my quarantine isolation, I'm running stairs, you know, just getting up, doing the stuff. My glutes and my abs are on fire, glutes and abs, and the hips feel good, the back feel good. It feels like I can do anything now. It feels like, okay, squatting 300 kilogram wouldn't be a problem. It would, but you know, at least I'm thinking it wouldn't. But GPP, nobody is caring about GPP nowadays. You know, there are a lot of kind of power in the powerlifting world.
Yeah.
There are a lot of powerlifters doing squat, bench, deadlift, and they are gifted powerlifters, and they are really good. They are young, they are good, and they are good since the until 20, let's say 6 or something like that. Then they get injured, and then they're out of the game, because they never cared about how can I be in the game for a really long time, and that's kind of a problem.
Yeah, they again, back to Dan DePasqua, he coined the term groove training.
Okay.
To where they train in a groove, and they're so good within that groove, but as soon as something gets either side of it, that's when injury occurs, or that's when something like non-positive happens, and they end up getting out. So that's why, I come back to GPP, you train general to be specific. Mm-hmm. You try to train in the range of motions that hopefully you'll never have to get in, but you build capacity in it, because if you find yourself there, your risk of injury is hugely reduced, because we've trained capacity in that motion. And that's what mostly most injuries are, is that when you get out of that groove, you haven't built the capacity to handle stress or strain outside of that, which is a big thing.
You don't need to be a kind of rocket scientist to know that if you can bench 200 and you can only do kind of 10 straight push-ups, there is something going wrong, you know? I mean, there's something serious going wrong. And I see some videos from home training, you know, home workout from some powerlifters. They can't do 10 push-ups, but they can press 200 kilo on the bench. I mean, there's no base.
There's none. And the only thing that can happen is bad. It's just a matter of time. It's not if, it's when. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people get wrapped up. Like, look, lifting heavy weight is awesome. There's no better feeling than hitting a PR on max effort day. Like, it is, it's crazy. But there's more to life more to training than that. That's why 80% of training, the 80-20 rule, is the accessories. And you have to be able to recover from workouts. Mm. So I think, especially now, people want instant gratification, especially getting the good old Instagram post out and the videos out. But GPP, again, without the best thing I ever heard was, you can't build a good house on a shitty foundation. Mm-hmm. So if you don't have that GPP foundation, like, you can have a real nice house, might look good at the start, but it might be a month in, might be a year in, eventually cracks start happening, and then you get colossal injuries. That's how a lot of these guys end up lifting great weights, huge weights, and 2 years later, they're gone.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of the stuff that is happening right now in the powerlifting world, especially in Europe. You got your 1, 2, 3 main lifts or exercises in one session, and then it's done. There's no kind of rep work after that, no this classic, the stuff that we like, some bodybuilding stuff, dumbbell presses or stuff like that, because it's not a direct carryover to the competition lift, but it's a long-term carryover to your competition lift.
I would go even further, that nobody is doing something beside weight training. Mm-hmm. And that's a big issue. You know, nobody's doing kind of movements they're not used to. And it's so important to do movements you are not used to, just to keep your, you know, for example, nervous system fresh. You know, you keep your nervous system adaptive. And that's one of the big issues. Nobody's doing kind of, you know, and if you're playing volleyball, it's no problem. And if you're running stairs, it's no problem. You know, it doesn't keep you away from the heavy training, because you have to do that anyway.
I can tell you, if you're doing jiu-jitsu beside, it's a problem.
Okay, maybe.
The central nervous system doesn't discriminate between any sources. All it knows is stress and force. So whether it's the more variations of it it gets, the more adaptive it becomes. Mm-hmm. So what's your guys' approach on how to train athletes?
Alex?
It kind of changed so much that when I told Peter last time, half a year ago, it would be completely different. But nowadays, the approaches that I give athletes, I try to get some training complexes that are kind of simple, you know, not too many exercises. They are in a certain intensity and volume range, and that doesn't change that much. It's just a kind of wave changing that, you know, it's just not the same every week, but it close the same every week. And I keep the exercises the same until they are not working anymore, and then I try to switch them. For example, I was completely different half a year ago. I kept the exercises the same, and I switched the intensity and volume. Mm-hmm. You know, but now I'm really into this. There isn't main exercise, and I keep the main exercise in. Okay, because for example, I believe that if you want to be good at the, for example, barbell squat, you should barbell squat. You know, but it shouldn't be the only exercise you do. The barbell squat is not the main exercise, it's the kind of secondary exercise on another day. The main exercise is one that is kind of changing. So, for example, a box squat with a safety bar, or a box squat with a yoke bar, or a spider bar squat, or whatever. And in the second session in the week, so a couple of days later, there is the normal barbell squat, but in a lesser intensity zone. Let's say only kind of 75% the first week, 80% in the second week, and 85% in the third week, and so on. And then all the other stuff is according to the athlete's needs. So the supplemental exercises and the accessory exercises are what I think the athlete needs, because of, I'm not doing the assessments you do, and I should change that. But, you know, according to the history of the athlete, according to a questionnaire, according to what I see, I change the accessories and supplementary exercises for every athlete. That is, and nowadays I'm giving them a lot of GPP, you know.
How long do you train your athletes for? Do you have a given like time frame you try to get everything done within?
You mean my athletes? My athletes I'm training for more than 2 years now. Mm-hmm. So I only, you know, because of my limited time, because of the gym, there's a number I don't want to exceed, and it's 10 athletes. So I only have 10 athletes, but they stick to my plan. They don't go away. You know, they are, half of them are already started internationally, and I'm kind of, you know, like that, because they are really good and I can work with them for a long time, and I see if the methods works or not working, and that's really cool. So I have them for 2 years, and they do what, it sounds kind of strange, but if I say, okay, train 3 times a week, they train 3 times a week. If I say they train 5 times a week, they train 5 times a week. So they, I have them as often as I want them.
That's huge. It's very funny. I'm not sure if it's because that's just the number, but I found the exact same. 10 athletes was as much as I could efficiently train optimally.
I
have a completely different problem, because as I'm the head coach of the Austrian powerlifting team, I have my athlete pool is quite bigger. So I have at least about 25 from the national team that are competing on an international level. But it's, some of them are built up by scratch from me. Some of them I got and they were already pretty strong. So it's a bit more a traditional approach on my athletes. It's that everybody get an plan that is individualized to them, but I completely be honest with you guys, 10 athletes, it's pretty much the amount that is the best to coach.
Isn't it crazy to think that when we learn about how to coach athletes, it's how to train one athlete?
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, it's so simple. And then they give you, here is 20 athletes, or in your case, 25 athletes. And you're like, oh, fuck. I can train one athlete really good. I got to do this for 25 more times.
Yeah.
That's where I think if you look into manufacturing, they become really good at logistics and how to train high numbers or how to get high numbers out optimally. And if any of you guys want to increase your reading literature outside of strength conditioning, that's where I would suggest, because some of these NFL or some of these football teams here, they have 80 athletes they have to work. And you stop becoming a strength coach and you start becoming a logistics manager.
Yeah. Absolutely. I was a strength and conditioning coach for an Austrian football team a couple of years ago for 5 years. And it was like, I didn't feel good, because I couldn't give every athlete the amount of time he would need. And that was a big problem within myself, you know.
But I think that's a difference between Europe or Austria and the US. You get your strength and conditioning coaches for the in-season. They have a limited amount of time, and most of the work is done in the off-season.
Yeah.
And I think they don't get any recommendations, even the pros. Isn't it like that in the US? Do your NFL coaches, your professional athletes get any recommendations for stuff to do in the off season?
They do, but the recommendation is pretty light, and the reason of that is, especially for the NFL, these guys are worth a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And strength coaches are very cautious, and rightly so, not to give them too much or the stuff where they can't supervise them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very, I couldn't grasp it at the start. I'm like, to me, the gold standard was to be a strength coach in the NFL. That was every budding strength coach's dream to be in there. And then you start realizing the amount of restraints the strength coach has to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
They end up becoming a maintenance worker to where they have to try and maintain, because they can't. They have to keep these athletes healthy. And heaven mm-hmm. forbid, if you get one of them injured, you might as well say goodbye to your job.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's hard. A lot of people don't realize, too, that if a team does well, the vast majority of the time, the strength coach gets no recognition. But if the team does bad, usually the first people to get fired are the strength and conditioning.
Yeah.
Even though they might have done their job to the T within the constraints given. Because you talk to a lot of these strength coaches individually, there's a bunch of stuff they'd love to do. And there's very few head coaches that give strength coaches the freedom to do what they think is the best way to train.
Mm. Yeah.
I've just forgot my question.
Really?
Yeah, I was thinking about the last couple of seconds, but I lost it. I think I just wanted to add one thing, that within my training kind of philosophy, I try to get these main exercises, which are not the powerlifting exercises, from a more weakness approach far before, you know, the competition, to a more strength approach when it comes to the competition. So they are training kind of, for example, if an athlete is really super weak in, if an athlete is squat dominant and is super weak in the glutes, I try to make some kind of squatting movements that fire the glutes
mm-hmm.
early on in the training program. And if it then comes to the competition, I want to prime the quads, you know, because this will be their strengths. So this is what I try to do with some athletes. Just wanted to add that.
How do you get feedback? Like, how do you assess what they need? Like, do you do it on a weekly basis, or do you do it by individual?
I try to do it from session to session.
Yeah.
So when they are training, and I'm not there, mm-hmm. very often I'm there when they are training. But when they are training individually, they are sending me feedback and videos within their, or at least short after their training session.
Mm-hmm.
And I give them feedback immediately. Sometimes they are sending me the videos, for example, or whatever, within the training session. And I try to give them coaching feedback right in the training session so they can adjust from set to set. But, you know, some of them are losing their focus when they are, you know, sending me some text messages. So I don't want to do that, you know, that much.
Yeah, it's pretty much the same for me. Most of them, they send me videos during the week, but they have to send at least one check-in per mail every week, per email, so that I get it in a structured way and not just a bunch of WhatsApp videos or.
Do you guys find this hard for remote training, in terms of trying to? Like, you're missing some sort of the feedback you get from having something in front of you when you're analyzing videos?
Yeah. I think the biggest thing is that you have to train, if it's possible, with your athletes. You have to coach them hands-on, let's put it like that. You have to be there. That's why we try to start some kind of club training where everybody is training on the same spot in the same time. And the best would be that doing the same things, you know, but that's individualized. So, but the best thing is that you stand beside them and just give them feedback from the first set from the warm up on. You are not ready to lift yet. Just try to warm up your glutes more, or you don't go higher with the weight, or go up with the weight, or whatever. You know, sit back, because if you just give one feedback a week or one feedback a session, you're losing so much time, man. If you have 20 sets within the warm-up sets, you can correct everything within one session, you know.
But it also depends on the level of the athlete.
Of course, it does.
I got some international athletes that are lifting since, I don't know, 12 years, 15 years, 20 years. It's possible for them to train alone or in their own environment, but especially at our club trainings, the beginners improved significantly in a short amount of time because Alex and another coach is standing beside them and telling them, do this.
Yeah. Use your glutes.
So if I'm a new athlete coming to work with you, how do you approach it from day one? So if a new athlete comes in, what is the structure you have in place to see what they need?
Pete?
I got a questionnaire sent to them. Most of the athletes that work with me, they have already competition experience. So I want to see the last videos from the last competition. And then usually in a competition, you can see a technique breakdown pretty good. So because most of my lifters are competing raw anyway. So I try to analyze the videos. If it's possible, I try to get the last training block in paper that they've done to get the volume and intensity in the right zone for the first block, and then I try to build up block after block, especially most of the times week after week. I get the next blocks in my head, but they get the weeks adapted every week, and pretty much like Alex, I'm focusing on the weaknesses on the first blocks, and then we're building the competition strength.
And when for example, if I approach you as an athlete and you are a coach, do you, for example, do you say, okay, yeah, my number is limited, so sorry for that, you kind of have to wait? Or how do you do that? I mean, for example, when you say, okay, I have a limited number of athletes, what do you tell kind of newbies?
I'm fortunate to where we've got a good network, to where I think there's the next best thing to training an athlete is referring an athlete to a coach you trust.
Yes.
So thankfully, I try to keep everyone that I think, okay, gels well with what we're doing, and then that cares about the athlete, and then I just refer. It was very hard at the start to say no.
Yeah.
And then I realized that, okay, I'm taking away from athletes. Like, to me, like, 10 is the max. The happy number is 5 athletes.
Mm-hmm.
And again, and I can say this because my full-time job is running Westside Barbell, the company. Mm-hmm. Then the athletes, to me, is what keeps me sane. Like, that's not work. But to do it effectively, if 5 is perfect, 10 is like to where that's a 20-hour day. Like that's a lot. But I try to refer to as many coaches as possible, because regardless of what your influences are, once you're doing it positively and you're achieving the results, then it's all good for the athlete. So I guess referral is my big thing.
Mm.
But that's hard, because I had to cut down my numbers for my private clients last year. And all of the good coaches that I know were already full.
It is strange, this whole, like, I think we all started out probably pretty much around the same time, to where social media was nowhere where it was or where it is now. So no one really wanted to be a strength coach, and no one really wanted to be, like, if you had told a strength coach he was a personal trainer about 10 years ago, you would have got punched in the face. And now it's very blurred lines. But it's crazy how big training is, working with athletes remotely is. And I agree with Alex that you have to work with them in person at least once, just to get the feel. What is your take on people who have hundreds and hundreds of clients?
Really? That's a sellout. Sorry.
I don't know how they manage that.
That's not correct. because there are some things. I don't want to start a rant on the online industry. I just try to put my thoughts into game. But I think, first of all, a lot of people are a lot too expensive for what they give. And if they gave 100%, they are still too expensive. So you don't get the best athletes, you get the richest ones. And the richest ones are not always the best ones. And I want to improve my coaching skills, and I want the best athletes and not the richest ones. So that's the first thing, but that's a kind of communist thing in my head, but okay. and the other thing is that I don't want that many athletes I cannot handle in a way I want to handle them. And, you know, I was, as you know, I was a teacher and working with kind of a lot of pupils and try to making them better. And it was, even then it was hard to not caring about everybody, but I knew that I just couldn't, you know, I just cannot handle 100 pupils learning them to squat. I tried, but I just couldn't, you know. And so if you also take money from them, that's bullshit.
I agree with you. It's, to me, it's complicated in the sense that I never want to belittle or begrudge anybody who's able to make an income in this demographic. However, I think a lot of them don't advertise honestly. I think if you're, there's a big difference from selling workouts than doing one-on-one training. So I think you can train thousands of people if you advertise these are workouts. I think that is perfectly fine, and it's up to you to follow them. And then if you can answer questions, great. But to me, I'm the very similar view set of, if you're providing unique training for everybody and you have 100 athletes, it's impossible that anyone's getting the individualization.
Absolutely.
And what I can't fathom is why that there's not any regulation. Like, we, if you take the US demographic, there is a certain amount of deaths per year from poor coaching. And yet there's still no worldwide governing body that holds strength coaches accountable for their actions, which I think is, in 2020, is crazy that there's no regulation or universal regulation for all coaches to be held to a standard, which should account for a lot of online coaches. And sadly, you may have 10 likes and be the best coach in the world.
Yeah.
But if you have 1 million likes, you're probably going to get most of the business, which is strange, because most of the coaches I know absolutely hate social media. Louis hates technology in general.
Yeah.
So it's a strange world to see, because when you came from before it and now we're living in it, we were kind of lucky that we got to see what it was like before social media.
Yeah, you're right.
But it's like everybody of us knew that if we want to go into strength coaching, we won't get rich.
Yes.
So we knew that from the start. And I think nowadays with this online coaching stuff, they try to make real money out of coaching. And we know that it's not really possible with a good sense of quality.
Yeah.
It is possible, but it's, as you say, Tom, you need to get money. No, we are living in a society that you need money. Okay, that's it. But as you say, if you earn it because of wrong advertising, let's put it like that, then this is the fine line I don't want to cross, you know?
Yeah. And it's hard at the start, I think, to find that line of like what's considered selling out and what's not.
I talked to my brother and he said that you have to scale products big that don't lose quality because of quantity, and he's right. If you sell books and you sell more books, they don't lose the quality, but you get more money. But if you make a second gym, for example, that's a quality lost. loss, because we can't be there and or there, or if we just make more online or more clients coaching, it's a quality loss. Mm-hmm. And if you for example sell online programs and you say, okay, this is a program,
yeah,
and I think it's good, and it's good for this and this and this reason, and because if you do it at home, I don't know, whatever, you know, okay, the quality stays the same, so it's kind of fine, you know. But if you are scaling things big, that making the quality worse, that's not good.
Yeah, and again, it comes back to who holds these people accountable. That's what I can't. Every other demographic has regulations on it. Like even supplements kind of like the Wild West, but at least there's some regulations. But now, I mean, the strength conditioning is kind of going down that deep dark rabbit hole. And we've seen it. Like we get a lot of athletes. We had one athlete tell us a crazy story. They are being coached one-on-one by a very, very high profile coach that we all know. And I paid a lot of money. Then come to find out, this athlete wanted to get another coach, went to the other coach, and he gave them the exact same workout. And he was like, How is this possible? Well, it turns out that one coach was being coached by this coach, and the workouts, that is getting complicated now, but sent over to this coach, he was sending out to all his athletes. So he wasn't even coaching.
No, he was just distributing programs.
Yeah, he was just taking from here and passing it on. So he was paying his monthly fee to this coach while he's coaching, I don't know how many athletes using his program. And I was blown away. One, that like that thought never even entered my head, and I'm like, okay. But two, I was like, geez, I wonder how much of this is going on.
Mm, yeah.
Especially because this is the times that we're in. I didn't mean to go down this rabbit hole, but to me, I think it's important that we talk about it, because if we don't, it's just going to keep going on and on and on until something bad, and like a lot of injuries are occurring out of it. Yeah. A lot of injuries.
But yeah. I think Alex and I have a good approach on that, because we once said, and we stand by that, our programs that we write for our athletes can be published online, and I have no problem with that, because I try to do a different program that fits every athlete, mm-hmm. not write one program for all of them. They're as good as individualization gets anyway. So I don't care if someone posts the workout, the whole workout, because the second athlete gonna get a completely different, or if not, it fits him just as good. So I have mostly powerlifters, and all of them are gonna do squat, bench, and deadlift. So I think
that brings us back to Westside. You know, a lot of people coming out of Westside are. They made a really good business, like Dave Tate or Mark Bell or Matt Wenning. And what do the people do? They are giving the knowledge away for free. You know, look at for example, Elite Fitness, the Elite FTS website. There are so many free articles. As on Westside, there's so many free information, and this doesn't, you know. That increases the interest in the whole thing, and that giving that they're coming back even more. You know, in Austria, a lot of online coaches or whatever, they are try to keep the programs and don't want to give information away, and that's the completely wrong way to run a business. You have to tell everybody everything you know.
The more they tell everybody for free, the more the guys come to us and gonna pay for that.
The best websites, the best information is out there, you know, and they are giving it away for free, you know, and they don't even bother if it comes back. But that's the reason, because they don't think about if something is coming back. A lot of things are coming back, you know.
It's like that's the truth, and the question then comes: how much content do you give out for free?
Yeah.
And again, the business side, like, nothing is free. Obviously, it's given us SEO value and all that. But when the basis is behind a more educated population makes better decisions, especially when it comes to strength training. At least it gives people a taste of, well, if Louis Simmons says this, Dave Tate says that, Mark Bell says that, well, you know what, there's a similarity between them all. Mm-hmm. And you're like, okay, maybe that's true. And I'll give Elite credit, like all their articles. They have articles that contradict each other, but at least they're presenting it to everybody. Like, this is how all these people train, which is a very, very unique approach.
And I
think people take that for granted. And the same with, like Lou writes, this man writes every day, just put out content and put out stuff. And it's, I think that's just that's the old generation's approach. And I think it's more valid today than it was when they first started.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's good to
end the podcast.
Thank you that we are talking about that, because that's a kind of big issue. And we Peter and I we are talking a lot about that. And it's good to hear that there are some other guys thinking kind of same way as we do.
Especially the guys that matter.
Yeah, especially the guys that matter.
but it's important that everyone who thinks alike sticks together, and that's one thing I've learned here from Lou. Regardless of what your training programs is, I think people think that there's this big war of training systems, and they not. Like, I can assure you, Lou does not care about anybody except his athletes. So if he can do something that makes them better, he's going to do it. But I think that the ego gets in the way for some people's methods. But I think if we all stick together, we'll all keep doing good content and keep our athletes healthy and strong.
You're absolutely right. Tom, thank you very much for taking your time from... Your time was 5 o'clock in the morning to 6:30 in the morning. And you told us that you were up on 3:30 a.m. So that's kind of crazy, but I love it. And thank you very much for taking your time. And hopefully, if you're coming back to Europe, I talked to my brother, and he told me, perhaps I can say that, even on the podcast, when finally we have the machines from West Side, and you have time, we want to invite you, the flight and the hotel, whatever expenses you have, to come to our gym and just showing you the whole equipment, hanging around and training. So you don't need to worry about the costs. So we take that. And if all things, you know, after the whole Corona thing is fine again, if you have time, you're invited.
Oh, it'd be my pleasure. And especially I have to travel back to Europe every year anyway, so that'd be no issue. And I appreciate the hospitality, and I do appreciate the good conversation and the opportunity to at least speak some of my thoughts. Hopefully there was some good out of it.
Yeah, thank you very much, man.
Thank you very much. Pleasure was on our side.
Have a nice morning.
Thanks, you guys. Bye-bye.
Bye.